Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Ja, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
I moved to Bellwether 3 years ago after my mother passed. It wasn't a decision so much as inertia. Her house was paid off and I didn't have anywhere else to be. It was one of those towns where people wave when they drive past even when they don't know you. Where the diner staff still remember your order, even if you've only been there once. I'd been picking up work where I could. Substitute teaching mostly. Sometimes weekend shifts at the library when the high schoolers flake. No one asked many questions. They liked that I was dependable. I liked that they didn't pry. There was a quiet stillness to this place. A hush that settled behind the curtains. Half the houses were empty, the other half held people who seemed to have calcified their routines. Church on Sunday, groceries on Wednesday, yard work until the first frost, and then radio silence until spring. Sometimes I think the town is like a snow globe someone shook a long time ago. Now all the glitter had settled, and we were just sitting in the stillness, pretending it was still beautiful. That's what made the painting so strange. They held the town's art competition in the converted church hall, same place we used for weddings, funerals, polling days, and bake sales. You could still see the old crucifix outline on the far wall, faded where the sun used to hit it before someone painted over it with a coat of beige. I wasn't supposed to be judging. I filled in because the usual guy came down with shingles, and someone remembered I taught high school art for 1 semester before they cut the budget. They said I had a good eye, which is a polite way of saying I'm quiet and not prone to arguing. Most of the entries were what you'd expect. Oil landscapes of fields following a Bob Ross tutorial. Watercolor portraits of dogs that all looked like they were melting. A kid submitted a clay sculpture that collapsed in the box on the way in. I liked that one best. At least it was honest. Then I noticed the butterfly just hanging there. It hadn't been there before. Maybe it was snuck in during the bustle of the event. It was dead center. No name or frame, just canvas, and a butterfly. I've seen photorealistic paintings before, hyperrealism, surrealism, digital rendering. This wasn't that. It wasn't just real looking, it was real feeling. That's the only way I can describe it. It looked like it had been pinned there while breathing, and the instant the brush touched it, it forgot how. Its wings were open, blue so deep it made black look loud. The body was textured in a way that made you think about words you hadn't used in years. Velvet, bone, oil. Nothing behind it, just a blank white void, like it had been painted onto the idea of a canvas instead of the thing itself. People started crying. Not everyone, but most. Just here and there. People sniffled behind me. A woman put a hand over her mouth. Even the mayor, the one who always made a point to say how he didn't get art, stood with his hat in his hands, nodding. I stood in front of it for 10, maybe 15 minutes, trying to see what they saw. But nothing came. I felt fine. I wasn't moved like the others were. I felt outside it, like I never got the memo. Eventually, I muttered something. I think it was incredible work or nice piece, and drifted back toward the refreshment table to get some air. That's when I saw Alice. She was standing a few feet from the painting, pale, maybe 17, hoodie with stretched sleeves, scuffed sneakers. She was motionless, eyes locked onto the butterfly. She looked like she'd forgotten how to blink. I watched her longer than I should have. At first, I thought she might have fallen asleep standing up. Then I thought she might be crying. She wasn't doing either. Just staring, with the same expression I'd seen on a man at his wife's funeral. Not grief exactly, but reverence, like something old was ending, and she'd finally accepted it. I cleared my throat as I approached. "Hey, you all right?" For a moment, she stayed silent, blinking slowly. Then she looked at me, really looked, and said, softly, "I didn't know it could feel like this. I thought I missed my chance." Then she turned back to the butterfly. And I just stood there, not knowing what the hell to say. In the days after the art show, the town felt lighter. That's the only word I could think of. There was no energy in the air, as if someone had gone around in the night and loosened some invisible knot in everyone's chest. People who spent years avoiding each other were suddenly talking again. I saw two brothers, the Whitcomb boys, hugging in the middle of Main Street like one of them had come back from war. Mrs. Halpin brought a pie to her ex-husband's place, and he cried on the porch until she hugged him. The Hendersons, who'd barely spoken since Christmas, were holding hands at the grocery store, smiling like teenagers. Everything felt softened. The whole town had been washed in warm water. Kindness blooming everywhere, fast and quiet, like the way mold creeps into drywall, spreading before you notice it's there. But I wasn't feeling any of it. I kept waiting for whatever hit everyone else to catch up with me, some sense of clarity or relief, or even just a nudge. Instead, it all passed through me like I was made of glass. Even Jacob was different, and he's about as stubborn as they come. I stopped by the garage one afternoon to say hi, and found him leaning back in a lawn chair outside the bay doors, eyes closed, smiling at the sky as if someone was telling him a story only he could hear. "Hey," I said, nudging his boot. "You all right?" He blinked like I pulled him out of a dream. "Never better," he said. "Feels good, you know, like something finally broke loose." "What did?" I asked. He just laughed, a small, private laugh that made me feel like I'd missed the joke. When I asked him about the painting, he smiled again and said, "It was something, wasn't it?" He looked past me, like something across the street was calling him. I turned to look. Nothing was there. I walked home, feeling hollow. It wasn't just the painting that bothered me now. It was me. Why hadn't I reacted like everyone else? What was wrong with me that I could look at that thing everyone else treated like a revelation, and feel absolutely nothing? That question kept bothering me long after I got home. Later that evening, as I was locking up the school after a PTA meeting, I heard footsteps echoing down the hall. It was Alice, wearing the same hoodie with the same distant stare. But this time, her cheeks were flushed, and her eyes had that shimmering look I'd seen on half the town. She stopped in front of me, breathing like she'd run all the way here. "I didn't think you would choose me," she whispered. Her hands were trembling, but she didn't seem scared, more like she was overwhelmed. "I haven't even told her I love her yet." "Who?" I asked. She glanced past me, toward the doorway. Another girl, tall, blonde, one of the basketball kids, was standing there, staring into the dim hallway with the same dreamy, softened expression most of the town had been wearing. Alice didn't answer my question. She didn't need to. She just smiled, small and shaking, and said again, "I didn't think you would choose me." I started noticing the gaps. That's how it felt, like blank spaces in a song everyone else had learned the lyrics to. People would speak in low, tender tones, like they were sharing something sacred. But every so often, I'd see someone watching from a distance, unmoved, out of step, like me. The first was the man in the rusted car behind the hardware store. I'd seen him before, sure. Just one of those forgotten fixtures you stop noticing until you have a reason to. He never begged or spoke, just sat in the front seat of that sun-bleached Buick, windows fogged from the inside, watching the world pass. After the painting, the town shifted, softened like overripe fruit. But he didn't change at all. He just sat there, a statue in denim and dust. Once I passed close enough to catch his eyes through the glass. He was staring straight ahead, unblinking, as if waiting for a radio signal only he could hear. I raised a hand in an awkward half wave. He didn't return it, just kept staring. Then there was the widow, Mrs. Laurie, who walked the cemetery each morning before dawn, always the same path. The same three headstones, her husband, her son, and someone else I didn't recognize. Most mornings, I saw her from my kitchen window, dark coat trailing behind her like smoke, hands buried deep in her sleeves. After the butterfly showed up, I started watching more closely, wondering if, like everyone else, she'd stop to stare at strangers with those new, gentle smiles. But she didn't. She moved the same way, slow and ritualistic. She never looked up. I tried catching her eye one morning, brought her coffee in a paper cup. She didn't take it, just looked at me like I was interrupting a conversation I couldn't hear. And then there was Nathan. He ran the post office, usually polite, efficient, and dry as toast. I didn't know much about him beyond the story everyone knew. He had been alone his whole life, never found a partner in this small town. In the week after the painting, when couples danced barefoot in the park and strangers confessed decades of buried affection, Nathan still walked his usual loop with mail tucked tight to his chest, jaw locked shut like he was keeping something from escaping. I thought for a second, there might be something between us, some shared understanding, like war vets who never served in the same war, but still recognize the look in each other's eyes. I tried to speak to him once, a throwaway line about how strange everything had gotten. He paused, nodded once and walked away. The others didn't speak at all, barely above the bare minimum for conversation. I wondered if this is how I looked the whole time I was here. To me, I was laying low, being inoffensive. Was I just as sour as the others not chosen? I kept wondering if it was a coincidence, or if we were all missing the same piece, something simple, something everyone else had that made them worthy of, whatever this was. Eventually, I stopped one morning when I saw Mrs. Laurie sitting in the church pews. She wasn't praying, just sitting, facing the blank wall where the painting had been. I sat a few rows behind her, let the silence stretch between us, until I couldn't take it anymore. "Why aren't you like the others?" I asked, my voice barely carried across the empty room. She didn't look back, just shifted her gaze slightly upward toward the ceiling beam. "Because," she said softly, "there's no one left for me." It wasn't bitter, wasn't sad even. It was just the truth. And suddenly, the space inside my chest felt colder than it had all week. It started with the lights. People standing on their porches, faces lit by candles they hadn't held seconds before. I saw the first group from my window around midnight. Six of them, walking single file down Main Street. They weren't speaking, but they were humming something low and wordless. Not a melody I recognized. It sounded more like a memory passed mouth to mouth. The next night, there were more. Couples holding hands, parents with children, teenagers moving like they'd rehearsed the steps in some school auditorium long ago and just now remembered the choreography. They didn't look possessed. That's the part I kept coming back to. There was no glassiness in their eyes, no twitching or convulsing, no signs of strain. They looked grateful, calm, like they were doing exactly what they were meant to do. Alice was with them. She walked barefoot through the grass, arms loose at her sides, her face tilted up to the stars like she expected to be lifted at any moment. She looked so alive, it hurt to watch her. I followed some nights, stayed far enough back to pretend I wasn't spying. They never turned around, never acknowledged me. Then, on the fourth night, I saw the dancers. Middle of the town square, a man and a woman, twirling slowly in the pool of light beneath a lamppost, their bodies close enough that you couldn't tell whose feet were leading. The man's shirt was soaked with something. I thought it was rain at first, but then I saw the dark streak trailing down from his eye. Blood. A slow, steady trickle, like a tear that got tired. No one seemed alarmed. People walked past without blinking. One man even clapped, as if it were a performance. That's when I started writing it all down. Not for posterity, for sanity. I needed to make it make sense. Dates, names, times, descriptions, how many people, what they did, how long it lasted. But the more I tried to track it, the worse it got. It was like trying to trace smoke with a pencil. I gathered all my notes, thoughts, and theories and went straight to the authorities. But no matter how much I urged them to action, the sheriff just stared through me, a soft smile on his face. I think what angered me was how sincere it was. He wasn't mocking me, gone to whatever was going on. Nothing added up. I stopped writing and just watched. One night, I saw Alice sitting alone at the edge of the pond, her reflection trembling in the water. I decided to speak to her. She looked up when I got close, smiled, soft and tired. "Why are you doing this?" I asked. Her smile didn't falter. She stood, gently. Then she reached out and touched my cheek. Not with pity, but with something that felt like an apology. "It must be so lonely," she whispered, "to have no one worth blooming for." And then she walked into the dark. And I just stood there, still not understanding whether she was trying to comfort me or mourn me. I went back to the church looking for Mrs. Laurie. I don't know why. Maybe because she was the only one who ever answered me without smiling like she knew something I didn't. Or maybe because I still believed, stupidly, that there were a few of us left who hadn't changed and were still sane. The doors were open. Candles lined the pews like sentries, wax pooled onto hymn books no one was reading. I found her sitting in the same spot she always did, back straight, hands folded. I sat beside her, close enough that I could hear the quiet creak of her breath. She didn't look at me, not right away, just kept her gaze fixed on the far wall. I turned toward her. "What is it?" I asked. "What does it want?" She smiled. That was the first thing that told me something was wrong. It wasn't bitter or distant or hollow. It was radiant, lit from within, the way they all were once it touched them. Then she said, so softly I almost missed it, "It finds what still aches," she whispered. "That's all it needs, a wound you've grown used to holding." Her voice had changed too, in cadence, like it had been set to music I couldn't hear. She finally turned to look at me, and for a moment, I thought she might take my hand. But instead, she just said, "You never learned how to ache, did you?" Then she stood, slow and graceful, and walked up the center aisle, her fingers brushing each pew like a rosary. She had found the ache, and I was alone, again. And now I couldn't even trust the silence I shared with her. The others, the ones like me, had thinned out. The man in the Buick was gone. His car sat empty, door left ajar, like it stepped out for a moment and forgotten where he was going. Nathan had closed the post office early 3 days in a row. No one complained. I stopped by once and saw him through the back window, holding something small, but I couldn't shake the fact that it looked like a weapon. I kept wandering around like a tourist in my own life, watching, listening, wondering if it was too late to be chosen, wondering if I'd missed whatever subtle invitation had passed through everyone else's blood. One night, I found myself at the edge of the park, just beyond the lights. Couples walked barefoot in the grass, teenagers sat in circles, head bowed, foreheads pressed together. You could hear quiet songs, not full melodies, just threads of harmony rising and falling in time with the breeze. I sat alone on a bench and tried to mimic it, the closeness, the warmth. I imagined someone sitting next to me. I tried to picture what it might feel like to have a memory that made your chest hurt in that beautiful, horrible way. But there was nothing there. It was like trying to start a fire with wet wood. Later, at the cafe, I ran into Maya. I hadn't seen her in years, not since she graduated. She'd drawn quiet, strange things that made the other students nervous. Now she was older, settled, but still had that look, like she was always 5 seconds ahead of the rest of us. She offered me a seat. We talked, lightly at first, then slower. At some point, I told her everything, not just about the painting or the others, but the hollowness, the fact that I'd been watching all of it from the outside, like a man pressing his face to the glass of a house he used to live in. She listened, really listened. Then she looked at me with something like sympathy, something like pity. "I think you want to be in love," she said, "but you never learned how." I didn't argue. She sipped her coffee, set it down, and added, "And I think you don't want to be alone when it happens." "When what happens?" I asked. She silently looked out the window at the people walking in pairs, bathed in amber light, faces turned up toward a sky I hadn't been able to look at directly in days. It wasn't quiet anymore. Not in the way it used to be. The stillness of a town half forgotten, where dust settled on windshields and dogs barked at nothing. Now the silence felt intentional, sacred, like everyone was holding their breath, waiting for the next note in a song they'd only heard in dreams. They'd started looking up more. It was subtle at first, heads tilted just slightly toward the sky, as if something faint was humming above the clouds. But now, people sat in fields at night, eyes wide open, mouths parted. Couples lay naked on blankets, fingers threaded together, whispering things I couldn't hear. They said they were ready. I found drawings scratched onto the bark of trees, crude spirals, insect wings, symbols that looked like musical notation but didn't follow any rhythm I knew. Behind the library, someone stacked bones in a perfect spiral. Bird bones, maybe, or squirrels, or something that once spoke. A few houses had windows open and candlelight flickering like hearts beating in sync. I passed one porch where letters were being burned, one by one, into a metal basin. Love notes, I think, or maybe confessions. No one seemed afraid, except me. I found Jacob outside the old grocery store. He was standing still, head tilted back, his hand resting gently on the cart handle, like he'd forgotten he was there. "Jacob," I said too loud, "come with me." He blinked slowly, then smiled, that same warm, distant smile everyone wore now. "Come where?" "Away," I said. "Just out of town, anywhere, a day even, just to see if it breaks, whatever this is." His smile didn't falter, but his eyes showed signs of mourning. "Please," I said. "I don't know what's happening, but it's not right. It's not..." He stepped forward and put a hand on my shoulder. There was real pain in his face, sorrow of something I had no knowledge of, like I was in the wrong for thinking this. "You're not being punished, Darren. You're just... not part of it." That hurt more than I expected, because there wasn't a drip of malice. It was pure truth, and truth doesn't bruise, it carves. He turned and walked back inside, leaving me with nothing but the sound of insects buzzing in rhythm I swear I'd never heard before. That night, I walked to the edge of town, There's an overlook where the grass gives way to gravel, and you can see the train tracks disappear into nothing. That's where I saw them. Two people, a man and a woman, sitting on a guardrail. I recognized them both. Neither had changed. They were like me, always had been, watching things from the outside. They weren't speaking, just holding hands, like it was the last rope tying them to something real. Then the woman began to cry, not from pain or fear, from relief. And the man, he smiled, just barely, but it was the start of a smile that comes from surrendering to something beautiful you were once terrified of. I watched, heart hammering, as they began to succumb to the phenomenon. And for the first time since this all began, I felt something split in me. Grief. Because whatever they were becoming, it was never meant for me. It happened just before dawn. I hadn't slept, not in days really, just drifted in and out of hours like a body floating on cold water. I'd been walking the town again, hoping the movement would give my mind something to grip. But when I turned onto Main Street, I knew something had changed. They were standing still, all of them, the changed, frozen mid-step, mid-conversation, mid-breath. A couple sat on a bench, foreheads touching. A teenager stood on a porch with a book half open in her hands. The mayor was parked at a stoplight, door ajar, his head tilted toward the sky. None of them moved. Their eyes were wide and wet, the expression you see in old church paintings, mouths parted just slightly, as if they were hearing something so beautiful they couldn't survive the sound. I stood in the center of the square, surrounded. The air felt thick, like it was vibrating just out of tune with reality. My ears rang from the pressure. Something was happening. Something was here. They looked up. Every single one of them, in perfect unison, tilted their heads toward the sky. Not in panic, but in recognition. Whatever they'd been waiting for had finally arrived. And then they began to bloom. It started with a shiver, a ripple through the crowd like a breath held and released at once. Shoulders loosened, mouths parted, eyes softened, something pulling at them from somewhere very far away. Then, the first tear opened. I saw it happen to a man near the fountain. A thin, perfect line splitting down the center of his chest. As gentle as if someone had unzipped a coat. There was no struggle, no gasp. His skin just parted. The flesh eased back on its own, curling outward. Muscle followed. It slid out in long, warm ribbons, thick, glistening strands peeling away from bone like silk loosened from a spool. Each sheet slowed downward with soft, wet sounds layering itself at his feet. His heart sat exposed for a moment, pulsing like a bright stone. Then, it softened too. Around me, the rest of the town began to open. I could hear it. That quiet peeling, that almost tender separation of skin from the living thing inside. It didn't sound violent, more like fruit being opened by steady hands. A woman's face split along a jawline, a child's spine pushed free in a slow arc, vertebra by vertebra. A man's arms shed their muscles in draped sheets, leaving the pale gleam of bone beneath. None of them screamed. They didn't even flinch. The tendons stretched like strings being pulled taut, then snapped with little pops, playful in how small they sounded compared to the enormity of what was happening. Fingers loosened from knuckles, cheeks peeled from skulls, ribs unfolded like petals. There was no blood, not a drop. Everything emptied itself cleanly, quietly, as if their bodies had been waiting for this, as if the machinery of being human had turned off its alarms and unlocked all its doors. And through all of it, their expressions. God, they looked euphoric. A woman whose eyes were already clouding over smiled like someone had just told her she could finally go home. A teenage boy leaned into his friend as his sternum opened, and they both laughed, breathless and relieved, before their laughter dissipated. Couples held hands as their bodies melted. Parents stroked their children's hair even as their own faces fell away. Some closed their eyes, others raised their arms to the sky as if embracing something descending toward them. No one ran, no one begged, no one tried to stop it. They welcomed it. Spines collapsed into soft white powder, skulls folded inward like drying paper, bones crumbled at the slightest breeze, becoming dust before they even touched the ground. I stood there and watched it all, watched the town peel itself open and spill into the air like light escaping a cracked shell. And something in me twisted, painfully, not from the horror, but from the unbearable truth threading through every smile, every sigh, every peaceful surrender of the body. They were happy. Every single one of them. Happy in a way I had never been. And suddenly I understood I never could be. And that, more than the skin and the bones and the dust swirling in the dawn light, was what shattered me. Then something rose from the center of the stillness, a shimmer at first, like oil on water, like air warping over pavement on a hot day. Then wings, massive, translucent, veined like stained glass, a body that flickered between forms I couldn't hold onto, not long enough to name, eyes like multifaceted mirrors, a head that never stopped turning. It wasn't the butterfly from the painting. That had just been a door. This was what had been waiting behind it. It rose from their remains, built from them somehow. Not their flesh, but what had been inside it. Love, familial, partnership, desire, all of it, shaped and refracted into something too beautiful to be real. It flew, soundless, weightless. It drifted over rooftops, trailing sparks of gold behind it, like the last light of a dying sun. It passed above me, and did not touch me, didn't even pause. I stood, I shouted, "I'm here," I said, "I'm still here." It didn't slow. I saw them, I watched, I understand now. Still, nothing. I dropped to my knees, coughing in the dust. My hands trembled, flecks of bone and ash clinging to my skin like snow. I tried to cry, but the tears didn't come. I tried to pray, but my voice was hollow. I tried to plead, but I had no one to plead for. Just me. And for the first time, it hit me all at once. All the quiet years, all the nice dinners, all the polite, acceptable small talk. All the chances I'd had to love someone, to ache for someone, to need, and how I'd missed every one. I collapsed into the ash, completely from emptiness. I whispered into the remains of 1,000 open hearts. I'm still here. I'm still me. Why? And the dust stirred around me, just faintly. And I heard it, from inside, like something had cracked open in the back of my skull, just wide enough to let the words in. Because there's nothing in you to transform. And then the wind blew, and the ashes of the ones I never knew how to love scattered into the morning. They found me 3 days later. I was still sitting there in the square, half buried in ash. It had settled into my hair, into the folds of my clothes, into the cracks of my palms. I don't think I moved the entire time. Maybe I slept, maybe I didn't. The days blur when there's no one left to tell you that time is passing. When the rescue crews arrived, boots crunching through what used to be neighbors and classmates and people I borrowed jumper cables from, I didn't react. A man knelt in front of me, asking questions, my name, if I was okay, what I remembered. But his voice was muffled, sounding like he was speaking from underwater. I kept staring at the ground. The dust shifted every time I breathed, little clouds lifting, swirling, falling again. If I stared long enough, I could almost imagine faces in it. Not their faces, just the impression of all the love they carried, hovering for a moment, before dissolving again. Eventually, someone asked, "What happened here?" I thought about lying or saying I didn't know, but the truth rose in my throat before I could stop it. "They were loved," I said, my voice cracked. "That's why they got to leave." The man frowned at me. To him, it was nonsense. And maybe it was, but it was the only thing that made sense to me anymore. They weren't killed. They became something they had always been reaching toward. And I didn't. In the days that followed, they kept me in a hospital an hour out of town. Clean sheets, tiled floors, a window that looked out over fields that had never known what happened in bellwether. Nurses came and went. A psychiatrist sat by my bed and tried to get me to talk about trauma and mass hysteria. But every time I closed my eyes, I saw them. Alice's smile opening like a second sunrise, Jacob lifting his head to the sky as if greeting an old friend, the way couples held each other as their bodies unspooled into light. They weren't afraid. They weren't alone. They weren't left behind. That last one hurt the most. Because somewhere beneath the horror and the dust and the quiet, gnawing loneliness, something else had taken root in me. Something I didn't want to name. I was jealous. Jealous that they had someone, anyone, whose love reached deep enough that it could echo into whatever came next. I didn't. And that was why I remained. People keep calling me lucky. They say I survived, that I was spared. But every night, when the lights dim, I lie awake in that hospital bed and wonder about the truth of it. The sharp, aching contradiction. If they're gone and I'm alive, I have another chance at love. But if I never had it to begin with, if no one ever felt that way about me, if I never felt it toward anyone, then is it even possible with this second chance? And if I did somehow learn to live this feeling, would I be whisked up into the sky? Or was that all just a one-off? Some mornings, I hope the answer will come. Other mornings, I hope it won't. Because the world feels wrong with this knowledge. Too quiet, too flat, like someone drained all the color or turned off the part of the sky that used to watch back. And sometimes, when I'm honest with myself, I wonder whether they were the lucky ones. The ones who got to bloom, the ones who got to go, the ones who weren't left behind to figure out how to start loving in a world that suddenly feels too big, too empty, and too late. But I'm still here. I'm still me. Maybe that means something. Maybe it means nothing at all.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.